Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he won't back down.
These murderers executed 6 of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head.
Yulia Navalny urges Europe to come up with a Russia plan.
No matter what Europeans' future holds, Russia will be part of it. No matter what Russia's future holds, it will be linked to Europeans' future.
And the Oasis reunion tour has put the spotlight on Ticketmaster again.
I think the whole Ticketmaster pricing scheme is reprehensible.
Today is Tuesday, September 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
I would define the end of the war in Gaza.
In Gaza.
When Hamas no longer rules Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday rejected calls to soften his demand to keep troops in the southern Gaza border area with Egypt as the price for a ceasefire deal, saying it was vital for Israel to control this key lifeline for Hamas.
What has changed in the last 5 days? What has changed? One thing. These murderers executed 6 of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head. That's what's changed. And now after this, we're asked to show seriousness? We're asked to make concessions? What message does this send Hamas? It says, kill more hostages, murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. The pressure internationally must be directed at these killers, at Hamas, not at Israel. We say yes, they say no all the time, but they also murdered these people. And now we need maximum pressure on Hamas. I don't believe that either President Biden or anyone serious about achieving peace and achieving the release would seriously ask Israel, to make these concessions. We've already made them. Hamas has to make the concession.
U.S. President Joe Biden was asked if he thought Netanyahu was doing enough to bring about a ceasefire.
No.
Hamas also doubled down on Monday, saying that since June, the group had been operating under new instructions on how to handle hostages should Israeli forces approach their locations in Gaza. Abu Obaida, spokesperson for Hamas's Al-Qassam Brigades, said Netanyahu's insistence to free prisoners through military pressure instead of sealing a deal means those prisoners will be returned to their families in shrouds. Their families must choose, he said, whether they want them dead or alive. With both sides seemingly unmovable, how does any deal move forward? Joining us now to talk about this is Rajan Menon. He's a non-resident senior fellow at Defense Priorities and a senior research scholar at the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University. So once again, we find ourselves in pretty much the same place we always find ourselves. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu came out today, rejected calls to soften his demand to keep troops in southern Gaza and double down on the war will be over when Hamas is no longer in charge of Gaza. Is there ever a way out of this?
Not in the short term. I think there are two problems. One is that Netanyahu depends for his political survival, because if his political survival does not work out, he faces legal consequences for a whole host of charges on far-right Israeli parties, two of whose members are represented in his cabinet. They are fervently opposed to a ceasefire on the theory that Hamas can and must be destroyed. As it happens, Netanyahu himself seems to believe that this is the case. So in the negotiations for a ceasefire, Netanyahu has maintained that he will not withdraw Israeli troops from the Philadelphia Corridor, which is the area just north of the Gaza-Egyptian border, for fear that Hamas will infiltrate arms from that area. Hamas finds that unacceptable. Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire and a full withdrawal of Israeli troops. Netanyahu wants, at best, as far as I can tell, a limited ceasefire with the return of the hostages. So there is a gulf between the two sides. Now, Secretary Blinken insists on saying, well, everything is all set and Netanyahu has agreed to the terms and Hamas is not. This is, at best, I think, a distorted view of things. The two sides have very incompatible motives, and I don't think we're any closer to each side coming to the point where there can be a deal, as far as the eye can see, anyway.
The other thing that happened today was Hamas came out and said that they have changed their operating instructions on how to handle hostages that are still alive as Israeli forces approach their locations. They didn't say it, but they basically said, if Israeli troops are on the verge of finding us, kill the hostages and move on. They actually, what they did say was that their families have to choose whether they want them dead or alive. That was a direct quote.
Correct.
Which means that they no longer see, I mean, doesn't that mean they no longer see the hostages as something they can bargain with?
I think what they realize is that the fate of the hostages has become an extraordinarily volatile issue in Israeli politics. Just yesterday, I believe it was, we saw mass protests, perhaps one of the biggest protests since the war began, against Netanyahu, arguing for a ceasefire that will enable all hostages to return. Now, Hamas is, of course, watching this and sees that this is Netanyahu's great vulnerability. So by suggesting that if the war continues and Hamas has its back against the wall, the hostages may not come home, that is meant to ratchet pressure up on him, clearly.
How do they unwind this, the two sides? What is the way forward?
This is the $64 million question. I think there has to be some event that leads one or the other side to rethink its calculations. On the Israeli side, it could be that the protests continue at such a rate that Netanyahu is forced to rethink his absolute commitment to the far right and his own philosophical position, as it were, that his policy will enable the complete destruction of Hamas, which I think is a bit of a fantasy, but that's beside the point. As for Hamas, it will have to make a calculation that if it insists on continuing the war, Hamas is a movement that attracts disaffected Gazans may survive, but the current leadership of Hamas and the fighting force of Hamas, the Qassam Brigades, will not survive. So until each side shifts its calculation in the way that I mentioned, I think a deal is not on the horizon. And so far, Scott, I have to say, I don't see either side moving in that direction.
Meanwhile, the population of Gaza must be in a despair so deep, it's unimaginable how this generation pulls out of it.
It is a horrific situation, and there are two things to be said about that. One is that the more we allow this to continue, and let us bear in mind that our political support and our weaponry enables the Israelis to continue this policy, the void between our commitment to and our repetition of our belief in a rules-based international order and what we are tolerating in Gaza becomes wider and wider, such that American political capital is used up in a dramatic way. The second point is this. Let us assume that Hamas is completely destroyed, just for argument's sake. You have tens of thousands of young men who have seen their fathers, their mothers, their siblings either killed or succumbed to disease or starvation, such that some future successor movement to Hamas that is a radical movement committed to fighting the Israelis will not lack for recruits. There are plenty of angry young men out there. Now, it's hard to know what proportion of the Gazan population holds Hamas for having put them in the eye of the storm, as it were, because the Hamas attack on in October is what led to the war, versus how many are willing to look past that and say, the Israelis are the ones who ultimately have wreaked such destruction on my homeland that I am now committed to stepping into the shoes of those who were once Hamas fighters. It's hard to know, but I don't think in the end this is any kind of way for Israel to win hearts and minds among the Gazan population. It's a humanitarian catastrophe such as we've not seen.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Scott. All the best.
Rajan Minon with Defense Priorities and Columbia University. Yulia Navalny, the widow of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, on Monday urged European countries to work together to develop a clear and future-oriented strategy for Europe's relations with Russia.
No matter what Europeans' future holds, Russia will be part of it. No matter what Russia's future holds, it will be linked to Europeans' future. We cannot close our eyes and make Russia disappear, fortunately. We cannot close our eyes and make Putin's regime disappear, unfortunately.
Speaking at the Bled Strategic Forum in Slovenia, Navalny, who succeeded her husband as head of the Anti-Corruption Foundation after he died in a Russian penal colony, urged politicians to work together to develop and implement this strategy. We're following these other stories from around the world. The U.S. government has seized a plane used by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, citing violations of sanctions and export control laws. U.S. Justice Department officials allege the aircraft was illegally purchased through a shell company and then smuggled out of the United States. South Korean police have launched an investigation into Telegram that will look at whether the encrypted messaging app has been complicit in the distribution of sexually explicit deep fake content. The feud between Brazil and Elon Musk has amped up. Starlink refused to block X as ordered by a Brazilian court. And in response, Brazil froze Starlink assets and is now threatened to revoke its license. X was suspended in Brazil because it did not name a local legal representative as required by law. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, the two major U.S. political parties are expressing concern ahead of November's election about election integrity, meaning the process of registration, the casting, counting, and certifying of votes, as well as adequately addressing any serious issues that arise. More from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, on Capitol Hill.
Democrats accuse Republicans of limiting access to polling stations and plotting to hamper the certification of the results. Republicans suspect Democratic Party operatives of tampering with absentee ballots, manipulating voting machines, and keeping ineligible voters on the rolls. The Republican nominee, former President Donald Trump, is facing criminal charges over his attempts to overturn his 2020 election loss.
I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election.
The Democratic Party's nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris, accuses Trump of undermining confidence in elections while she pledges to uphold fundamental American principles.
From the rule of law to free and fair elections to the peaceful transfer of power.
Federal agencies have been conducting tabletop exercises mindful of January 6, 2021, when Trump supporters, unhappy with the president's defeat, stormed the U.S. Capitol. Has the preparation strengthened election integrity? That is the hope of stakeholders such as the 104-year-old League of Women Voters, whose chief executive officer is Selena Stewart.
But I guess it's a wait and see. We'll have to see what happens, what the outcome of the election is, how people feel about it, what protest, and whether that protest crosses the line into violence. And my hope is that it doesn't.
So far this year, the system has held up well, according to the chairman of the Federal Election Assistance Commission, Ben Hovland.
We've had a lot of primaries already, both the presidential primaries this year, but state primaries. And so election officials have had a lot of practice already this season, and I think we're in good shape going into November.
Election officials in Champaign County struggled to get results out last night.
In Champaign County in the state of Illinois, the local Republican Party in 2020 tried to have a judge compel the county clerk, Aaron Ammons, to stop counting mailed-in ballots.
And he dismissed that claim, and I was able to count the ballots. But they definitely tried it, just like they were trying in other places across the country.
Threats, intimidation, and lawsuits have prompted many election officials and volunteers nationwide to quit, according to Ammons.
It does a disservice, and it really is disheartening to the people who do this work if we're not getting the support that we obviously need for being on the front lines of democracy.
It is important to invite candidates, party officials, and the public to watch the system in operation, according to the Director of Elections in St. Louis County, Missouri, Eric Fay.
Opening mail ballots, tabulating ballots, testing voting equipment, manually recounting, auditing after the election, all of these things are publicly observable.
Senate Republican leadership wants to pass legislation that would require people registering to vote provide proof of citizenship. Most Democrats here on Capitol Hill argue the law already makes it illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, and there's no evidence to support claims that illegal immigrants in significant numbers are voting. Steve Herman, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
Congo's eastern city of Goma held a memorial service on Monday for 200 victims of the conflict between the army and the M23 rebels. The rebels have been waging a renewed insurgency since 2022. The time and circumstances of the killings were unclear, but authorities said the victims, from unarmed civilians to volunteer defense forces, died in the fighting in the country's militia-plagued east. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. In the United States, there's a fairly large homeless problem. A U.S. Supreme Court decision in June now makes it easier for communities across the nation to fine and arrest people living and sleeping in public spaces. Angelina Bagdasarian looks at what California, a state with one of the country's biggest homeless populations, is doing to address the problem. Anna Rice narrates.
Officials in Los Angeles County clear out tent camps, even if they have nowhere else to go. America has estimated 650,000 homeless people on a given night. Sheridan, who didn't give his last name, is among them.
Basically, what happens is they have a war against the homeless, okay?
He moved to California from Wyoming, but says his dreams didn't work out. He found himself without a home, but did not want to live in a shelter. So he's been living on the streets for the last 5 years.
There aren't enough affordable housing units. There aren't enough shelter spaces. There isn't anywhere for people to go.
According to a federally required count, more than 75,000 people are homeless on an average night in Los Angeles County alone. Dash, who also declined to give his last name, says the problem also affects people like him who live and work in the city.
It's a really complicated issue. I've had my experience with dealing with the homeless. I've been assaulted before. I've had the police involved.
For Angelina Bagdasarian in Los Angeles, California, Anna Rice, VOA News.
With New York's famous Fashion Week coming, here's a story about aspiring fashion designers in New York City, where the path to the industry is usually higher education at something like the Fashion Institute of Technology or Parsons School of Design. But for those without the means or access to schools like that, a Harlem-based fashion incubator, a company that helps new fashion designers grow and learn the business, is providing alternative paths to the industry. VOA's Tina Trin takes us there.
There's something so beautiful about making something that is an art that people wear every single day.
For Trey Malone Buchanan, the art is fashion. He's a design apprentice at SO Harlem.
I love to create clothing.
But in the city's ultra-competitive fashion industry, Buchanan has no illusions about the challenges of breaking into the field. A 2021 report by the Council of Fashion Designers of America and clothing company PVH Corp. surveyed over 1,000 employees across 41 fashion companies and found that 2 in 3 Black employees experienced microaggressions and were often the only minority in the room.
It's a very closed group. Sometimes you really gotta just slide into the back door. Sometimes you gotta wiggle your way in.
It's why spaces like SO Harlem are critical for creating pathways for young talent like Buchanan and fellow apprentice Noah Joseph.
I might not be what I'm doing if it weren't for SO Harlem, like at all.
Joseph couldn't afford traditional fashion design school. The nonprofit has helped launch more than 20 micro-businesses, including Joseph and Buchanan's respective clothing lines. Along the way, it has trained unemployed and underemployed locals and assisted with job placement. For young aspiring designers like Buchanan, it's reassurance that they're on the right track.
It took me years to really like get that confidence up to be like, you know something? Because, you know, being in this industry, or at least trying to get inside this industry, can be such a hassle.
The self-described introvert has found a vehicle for expression.
Because I don't talk as much, I always feel as if my work has to speak louder than myself.
And at this Harlem studio, the designs speak for themselves. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
And finally,
I think the whole Ticketmaster pricing scheme is reprehensible.
In this age of computer connectivity, the way we shop and buy things has changed dramatically. And that includes concert tickets. You're not just buying from a near monopoly. You're buying from a near monopoly with a computer algorithm.
Dynamic pricing, and it's something that we, I think, are all quite familiar with, whether it's sort of airlines or hotel rooms or train tickets or Uber surges. But I think we haven't really seen it so much before, maybe in sort of concert tickets in this country.
That's Shelly-Ann Horn, a competition economist and partner at business advisory firm Grant Thornton. As fans jumped online to buy Oasis reunion tickets, the computers at Ticketmaster saw the surge and started adjusting prices.
So what was happening was basically the sort of algorithm was looking to balance supply and demand. So as sort of demand was increasing, demand was high, it tries to find that price that really balances supply and demand, that sort of clears the market. And that's what it did. So the sort of prices went up when demand was high. And, you know, as we got towards the end of the day, towards, I think, 7 o'clock, when the tickets were sold out, potentially the prices maybe started falling again at that price.
Okay, sounds reasonable. But here's the reality. People who waited for more than 3 hours, thinking they would pay the initially advertised rate of $195 per ticket, ended up paying more than double, $466 a ticket, to get their hands on those tickets for the British band's reunion shows next summer.
It feels pretty crazy, like how much money it is. Yeah, I don't think I would spend that much money on one night. I guess it shows kind of capitalism at its finest.
The increase in demand has also seen some resale sites like Viagogo selling tickets for as much as $5,282. Britain's government says it will investigate how prices for concert tickets sold on official websites are increased when demand surges. The U.S. filed a lawsuit against Ticketmaster in May to split them from Live Nation, claiming it was a monopoly. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Thank you.